This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Some parents just dread the empty nest syndrome, that time in life when all their children have graduated school and moved on to make a life of their own. Hey, some parents look forward to it. One thing is certain, a whole lot of nests aren't as empty as they thought.
There's a very, very different way of living now that people in their 20s melting into their 30s experienced than their parents did.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about college grads moving back in with the folks. We'll also spend some time with the new president of the University of Vermont and spend an academic minute developing a social memory. I'm Bob Barry, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. A few years back, Sally Koslow was settling into an empty nest. Her two 20-something sons were launched out of the house into the wider world. And then suddenly and unexpectedly, her sons landed back home. She was startled and depressed to learn that they were part of a much larger trend. According to the Pew Research Center, 1/5 of young adults aged 25 to 34 live in multi-generational households. That means they're back in with the folks. The bad economy is the main contributing factor, but the trend also reflects shifts in social norms. In her book, Slouching Towards Adulthood, Observations from the Not-So-Empty Nest, Koslow explores these changes and presents her research and interviews on the phase she calls adult essence. The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue recently spoke with Sally Koslow and asked if it helped to find out that she was not alone in this situation.
Well, there's great comfort for parents to realize that the situation that they're facing with the young adult who's returned to the nest, that their child is not atypical, but their child actually is the norm. There are a lot of behaviors coming home to live with parents again beyond college is just one of them. There's a very, very different way of living now that people in their 20s melting into their 30s experienced than their parents did.
Is there a clear definition of leaving the nest in the sense of, okay, you go to college and then you return right after college, or you go out, you try to make it in the world, and then you come back?
Well, both things happen for many reasons. One is that there's a tremendous amount of student debt loan now, so that on the average, it's $45,000 per graduate in the United States. So many young people simply can't afford to be on their own. They are, like it or not, they are forced into being with their parents. Sometimes it's because children are a little bit spoiled and they like the creature comforts that the parents' house affords, that they want the cable television and the house, the freezer full of premium ice cream, and they would like their mother still doing their laundry. So we see extremes.
It's interesting because, you know, I think of myself as when I went to college and I was working in radio, and I don't know if you know this, Sally, but sometimes journalists and radio people don't get paid a lot.
I never noticed that. I know. I've been editor for decades.
I didn't know if that was a shock to you or not. And you know, you had, and there was that comfort, and both my parents said, well, okay, you know, stay here. We'll figure it out. Mm-hmm. And then it took maybe 2 years. I got a full-time job and then, you know, married, and then I went out. But I don't know how else the kids do it, right? I mean, in the sense of when I talk to students today about, journalism in particular, of how else do you do it without having that footing? But it seems like what you're talking about is a little bit more.
Well, there used to be a tremendous eagerness for baby boomers to become adults. People wouldn't be caught dead going home to live unless with their parents. And they wanted, when I went to college, a lot of people tried to finish college in 3 years instead of four. Now it's unusual for people to finish in 4 years because many people take 5 or 6 years. There's just a slower, that's why I called it slouching toward adulthood. There's a slower incline toward becoming an adult. And part of that reason, I think, is that baby boomers themselves don't want to age much. We see that reflected in all the joint replacements and the Botox and the hair color and just the general attitude of a baby boomer parents, people in their 50s, early 60s, wanting to feel like they're still 35 or 45, which is all well and good, but if you are that age as a parent, the message it sends to your child is that there's all the time in the room to make decisions about what you might want to do when you graduate from college. There's not necessarily a lot of thought when kids are in college about where the jobs might be later on. Everyone's encouraged to follow their dreams. This is the standard commencement speech. Have encouraged their children to pursue their dreams and to want nothing for the best for them. So it's a complicated picture.
So what's too long, do you think? I mean, at what point?
What's too long? It's too long when it starts to get infantilizing and crippling for the young adult, when the young adult doesn't have a plan. And that's where parents tend to bomb, because they don't think that they should be talking about this with their adults, young adults, their adult essence. They treat them, if they're 28, like they're still 18. They don't expect them to kick in financially, and if not financially, at least in doing chores around the house or helping to take care of the lawn or change the oil in the car, whatever would be helpful. It gets to be too long when kids stop making plans and when parents just see them lounging about and maybe depressed. I mean, there are reasons to be depressed if you're a young person in America, because there are 8 people clambering for each job that's available, and many entry-level jobs are unpaid internships. So there's a lot of reason to feel that the younger generation's been screwed, but this is our reality right now. You have to respond to it. You might have to take a job that's not your perfect job or move to a place where there are more opportunities. You may have to reset your goals.
And this goes for the parents and the children, right? I mean, because obviously the young adult is greatly impacted by this, but so is, and for all those economic forces that are impacting the child, so goes it with the parents as well. More time spent at work, more time, more responsibilities, and meanwhile you're also trying to shoulder this other responsibility and be a good parent in the process. That's a really hard mix for everybody.
It's very hard. It's a really tricky dance when you've got if you're a parent and you feel as if your child is floundering. And it's almost irresistible as a parent to rush in and try to solve all their problems. But there's a famous Jonas Salk quote that we all heard, children need roots and wings. And sometimes parents clip their kids' wings if they try to be too helpful. There are certain things in life that you can only teach yourself, how to get along at work, how to accept rejection, how to motivate yourself in the face of rejection to try again. Parents sometimes fall short in trying to do too much, and it turns out to be counterproductive. And it all comes out of a place of love, but it isn't helpful ultimately.
And doesn't it come out of a place of, okay, I'm just going to give it this last push, one last try, and then we can move on
except
from this?
There usually isn't. There's usually one more after that and one more after that.
Yeah, but you don't know that going into it. That's the problem, right?
Right, right. It's not easy to be the kid, but it's also not easy to be the parent, because it's hard to experience any kind of tough love as a parent. But sometimes that's what you need to offer.
When it came to your personal situation, is there any aspect of it that you look back fondly on of what you experienced?
Absolutely. I was thrilled when I heard that my son was 25 and he was moving from San Francisco, returning to New York. I was very happy because we hadn't had much time alone with this young guy in a long time, because he had a younger brother, so we hadn't focused on him alone for years. And it was wonderful. In the beginning, he came back for a job, and then the job fell through. And then he started seeming pretty laid back, too laid back for the standards of my husband and myself. And we heard he actually had been offered a job, but it wasn't in any way his ideal job, so he was going to decline it. And we thought he was crazy. And we pushed him to take it, and he took it. And then he moved out into an apartment with a bunch of guys in Brooklyn. And in all had a very happy ending. But I think if we hadn't pushed him, I don't even know how much time would have gone by until the next job offer would have come through, because I don't think he was that motivated. There was no stigma in being unemployed.
And
there's so many young people unemployed that there's a lot of comfort in the numbers.
Yeah, and that's become the norm now, hasn't it?
Well, it's not completely the norm. I mean, there are many exceptions to this rule. I mean, there are many people who go right on to law school or medical school or right on to becoming a teacher. But there also are so many people unemployed. I mean, and so many people living at home and so many people who owe money that you can easily find other people just like you, and it can slow down your push toward resolving the situation by looking around and thinking, well, this is what he's doing too, and you can start to feel that it's too normal.
I saw two sides of this. One was at a college commencement where I heard the speaker basically say, you have incredible challenges now because most of you won't be able to find employment and certainly not be able to find employment in the fields in which you were chosen. And that struck me. And then also my niece just started to go to college, and I was at a introductory seminar where, you know, we were dropping her off kind of thing. And the person said, you know, you come into this and you look, and we know that it's going to be a really rough road, and we hope that you'll find work, but obviously there's no guarantees. And but I don't know if that is realistic thinking or that it perpetuates this idea that, again, unemployment is sort of is the norm, or can be more accepted. I shouldn't say the norm, but more accepted.
Well,
and as you say, you know, your son becomes, you know, too complacent with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think actually there should be step two for those pep talks or those sort of anti-pep talks that you heard, because the second step should be, so in the face of this situation, this is what I suggest that you do. And maybe you consider not going to the most popular places to live in the United States, like New York and Washington, D.C. and L.A. and San Francisco. Maybe you go to flyover country where, I mean, I happen to hail from Fargo, North Dakota. And North Dakota has the lowest unemployment in the United States. They have jobs that go begging. They sometimes have to recruit people to go to college there. And it's really a very nice place to live, although it is rather cold in the winter. So you might want to rethink where you're going to live, and you might want to rethink what you're going to major in college. Maybe you don't want to be a dance major with a minor in the history of fashion. Maybe you want a job in the healthcare industry. Maybe you want something connected to the environment or some kind of engineering where there are lots of jobs. I think that this is where both parents and students fall down. There's too much of a, well, college is strictly for exploration. It shouldn't be to prepare you to work. But maybe there should be a bit more thought on the latter.
Again, the name of Sally Koslow's book is Slouching Towards Adulthood, Observations from the Not-So-Empty Nest. She spoke with the best of our knowledge's Joe Donahue. Still to come, there's a new president at the University of Vermont. We'll get to know him next on the best of our knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for the best of our knowledge, number 1141. This is the best of our knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. The University of Vermont has a new president. E. Thomas Sullivan took the top spot at Vermont's largest college in late July. The best of our knowledge's Pat Bradley got to talk to Sullivan about his new job and vision for the campus.
E. Thomas Sullivan, who prefers to be called Tom, comes to the University of Vermont from the University of Minnesota, leaving his position of senior vice president for academic affairs and provost. He was named president of UVM in February and has been transitioning to the position since.
I'm even more excited today than perhaps the day when this was announced, because I've I've learned during this transition period how very strong and how highly well-regarded the university is in the eyes of many people. I'm coming to a university that is strong and has very solid foundations, and we have issues and opportunities ahead, but we don't have many of the same challenges and difficulties that many of our peer institutions have in higher education.
President Sullivan, the university just released a strategic initiative project. What's your assessment of the initiatives that are put forth in this project?
Well, I've been following and have been briefed over the course of the last several months on the strategic initiative process at the university. I think it's very important that leadership of our universities take seriously strategic planning. It's one of my deep interests as well as experience. And the key here is to make sure that we identify our priorities, where our strengths and comparative advantages are, and then make sure that the budget is aligned with those key priorities, and be very clear and transparent about we can't be all things to all people, that we should make our investments and we should set our priorities and accordingly the budget in a way that identifies where the strengths and qualities lie and what we simply can't do because we can't afford or they're too costly to engage in. So I'm very pleased that the university has been deeply engaged in the last couple of years with regard to serious strategic planning and the important discipline of aligning the budget with those identified academic priorities. It's a process that I'm very comfortable with, and it's one that I want to spend a substantial amount of time on.
Tom Sullivan, have you determined where there might be problems or improvements in the bottom line that you can actually address?
It's too early at this point to have any clear decision on the 2014 budget. My first meeting on the budget is actually scheduled for this week. But I do know that we're going to be very focused and disciplined about aligning the university's priorities with its academic strengths and comparative advantages, and to be very clear about what we can't afford to do so that our students and our faculty and our constituents know exactly why and where the university is strong and why it's strong and where it's putting its commitments accordingly. So we're going to take a very good look at the upcoming budget and begin to further that budget prioritization process.
Tom, I understand you like fundraising.
And yes, I do very much.
Well, the University of Vermont just came off, apparently, its best fundraising year ever. How
yes.
do you plan to maintain that momentum?
Well, first of all, we have a new, very young, dynamic president of University of Vermont Foundation. The foundation itself is relatively new in the last year, and it has great promise, and I'm very much encouraged by the leadership of the foundation, the fundraising arm of the university, and I'm very much looking forward to working closely with the leadership in the foundation and with our alumni. We are beginning to plan a major comprehensive campaign, and I'm very enthusiastic about that. As you can tell, I do like fundraising. But the important point is that it's fundraising for the sake of increasing the quality and the value and the reputation of the university so that we can make sure that we're aligning our budgets with the top priorities of the university so that our students will get an absolutely first-rate academic and cultural and social experience as they attend the university for 4 years here, and that our faculty can have the facilities and the infrastructure to do very creative, imaginative research, to be able to promote knowledge and understanding, to really, quite frankly, make our lives better in Vermont and the broader community beyond. So I'm excited about the plan that we're beginning to discuss for a major comprehensive campaign. And everything looks very positive about our ability to be successful to raise a substantial amount of private funds to really make the appropriate investments in the university to help move us significantly to the next stage in the development of the university.
What is your long-term vision for UVM?
My long-term vision is to be able to enhance the quality and the value of this university and the experience that our faculty, staff, and student have, and to take it to the next level of excellence in all that we do, whether that's educating, whether it's breakthrough research, whether it's public leadership and public service, whether it's engagement in our communities, so that people in Vermont, people in our region, people in the country will realize that the University of Vermont really is one of the premier public research universities that has an ideal culture and size. That's the exciting part about being here at the University of Vermont. We have a real comparative advantage on our size and scale and the quality that I think is demonstrated every day in the classrooms as well as in our research accomplishments.
UVM President Tom Sullivan is an expert on antitrust law. His wife is a 1977 graduate of the college. Reporting for The Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Pat Bradley.
Could using social media improve the performance of your memory? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. The prevalence of social media has changed the way we interact with friends, family, and coworkers. And whether you love it or hate it, it's here to stay. But as Tracy Alloway, assistant professor of psychology at the University of North Florida, explains, social media sites force us to interact with information in a way that may have cognitive benefits.
Working memory brings together information from different parts of the brain so we can use it. If you're thinking about information, then you're using your working memory. This is an important cognitive skill that impacts all areas of your life. For example, if you are at a job interview and you get a curveball question, your working memory gives you an answer that combines what you know about the company with your particular skill set. Result? Working memory gets the job. In my research, I found that some technology, like Facebook and computer training, boosts working memory. I found that people who use Facebook more have better working memory. Facebook makes you think about information. Take the news feed. You see all of your friends' updates, and you have to make a choice about which is most interesting. You find an update about Mark's coast-to-coast road trip, so you combine this fact with your summer schedule and make plans to meet up in Tennessee. I have also done research on a brain training program called Jungle Memory. In clinical trials, I tested students with reading and math difficulties. I found that those who trained regularly with Jungle Memory showed fantastic improvements in working memory. But the most exciting thing was that their grades also improved, from a C to a B or a B to an A after just 8 weeks of training. 8 months later, and they still maintained all these improvements. I'm excited to be doing cutting-edge research on technology and working memory.
That was Tracy Alloway of the University of North Florida. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.